What do Clojure, event-driven architecture, logic engines, compilers, and MicroCamren have in common? Well, if you add a little bit of Kafka into the mix, you have my conversation today with Tim Baldrige. We talk about everything Clojure and Kafka people love on today's episode of Streaming Audio, a podcast about Kafka, Confluent, and the cloud. Hello and welcome back to another episode of Streaming Audio. I am your host, Tim Berglund, and I am joined today in the virtual studio by my friend, Tim Baldrige. Tim, welcome to Streaming Audio.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Tim, it seems like we've had a number of Clojure people on the podcast recently, and that maybe that's just recency bias. Maybe the numbers aren't really all that high. I should look at some actual data. But you are a person who hails from that community, and the subject we're going to talk about today is, like, I don't know, one of the just the Clojure-iest thing I could imagine talking about, and that is a framework called MicroCamren. But before we get to that, as always, I love for guests to tell us about themselves. Tell us about you.
Yeah, so I'm a software engineer. I currently work for Cisco in their Threat Grid department, which is a malware detection software as a service. And I mean, we have on-site solutions as well. But we intake viruses, we run them in a secure environment, and note down what they do and make that information available for searching. So what I currently do is work on the backend services, which are a lot of indexing of data produced by these viruses and, you know, retrieval of that information, searching and that sort of thing. And that kind of is the current incarnation of what I've spent maybe a good past 8 years of my job history working on, is a lot of that backend data processing type of thing. So some streaming applications with streaming data, and also a fair amount of query engines and logic engines and that sort of thing. Compiler tech, a little bit of that as well. Before coming to Cisco, I used to work for Cognitect, and I was there for 6 years, the maintainers of Clojure. And while I was there, I had a hand in developing Core Async and a couple other libraries that are part of the Clojure ecosystem. So.
Awesome. And so, I mean, data engineering, it sounds like what you've been doing recently is a good way to describe that.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess that'd be one way of describing it. Yeah. I often just think of it as, processing, trying to find new ways of processing data. A lot of the data I've worked with is either extremely messy or in the current case, there's just a lot of data that could be queried in a lot of different ways. And when you get too much data, you get to a point where it's hard to anticipate all the ways a user may try to retrieve that data. So a lot of my software tends to focus on query engines, self-optimizing query engines and the like that maybe take into account the domain knowledge that we have about the data we are querying. So a generic SQL query engine, for example, may look at the data and say, hey, here's what it looks like on disk, but it may not know specifics about the data that apply to your domain. A good example of this was I worked for a bank for some time, and you would think that transactions in this foreign exchange bank would be more or less spread out, and so the amounts would be fairly random, well distributed. And as it turns out, banks tend to trade primarily in a single monetary value. I forget what it was, 20 million or something. If banks are transferring between themselves and then they're doing foreign exchanges, it's always like $20 million for whatever reason. So, you know, all the optimizations were off because if it was one type of trade, the amount was always 20 million. If it wasn't, then it was evenly distributed. And so there's a lot of these sort of things that if you have more control over the query engine, maybe through something like Datomic or a custom built solution, you can, you know, leverage that knowledge and put a little more optimization in that wouldn't be there from a generic situation.
Right. A general purpose query engine.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that, all of that that you just said, you know, that you're into compiler design and logic engines and the particular kinds of query engines you're talking about, are the most Clojure person kinds of interests that a person can have. So you are being true to type, and it is a delightful type, if I may say.
Oh, thank you.
Look at here. And on that point, so these days, most people are driving less, listening to podcasts less. If you're listening to this podcast and it's in the evening, and if it's your habit to have a drink in the evening, when Tim says hammock time, you should take a sip of the drink. Okay. And I want to make sure that this is a moderate and healthy thing. So don't, you know, some people make the joke, do a shot. Whatever you do, don't do that. That right. won't be good for you. If Tim says hammock time, take a sip. So we want this to be, you know, an enjoyable and moderate sort of.
There you go.
And okay, another lead I don't want to bury is that, Tim, you're not a Kafka guy, right? That's not.
No. Yeah. So yeah, we were discussing that a little bit earlier. So I worked for Walmart as a consultant. So a lot of the jobs I'll talk about here with Clojure, with the exception of Cisco, were all under Cognitech. We were consultants. And one of the most successful projects I had the pleasure of working on was with the Walmart e-receipts services. So there was at the time a problem Walmart had that, well, not even a problem, an opportunity is the way I look at it. There's a certain amount of restrictions around PCI compliance. The idea that you can't just take transactions from a retail store and ship them across the internet. There's a lot of restrictions in place about that because obviously you could have problems with people stealing credit cards, personal information, that sort of thing. But as it turns out, the information on a receipt itself that's printed out by the receipt printer has basically no information on it at all, except for perhaps a customer number and the number of items and the type of items they purchase. So right there, the amount of regulation over that is very low because there's a certain amount of anonymity to that. And this was recognized by a man by the name Anthony Markar, who started a company with his friend, and I forget the name of it, but they were bought out by Walmart. And their idea was to tap into that receipt printer feed. Basically, the first iteration, funny enough, was a little dongle you would attach to the computer, and it would just listen to the parallel port on the receipt printer. And then they would just ship that to a server. So when Walmart got their hands on that, they had a little more oomph, and they could do things like write printer drivers that would fork the data stream inside the receipt printer. But that was the idea that you have this stream of mostly anonymous data, customer number and the information on the receipt. And what they realized with that is most of your customer information is stored on a server in the store behind a locked door, you know, and a chain link fence and all this other stuff, as it should be. But you can take that data and ship it out across the internet, the anonymous data that doesn't have all that personal stuff in it. And you can put that in a central server, which is what they did. So while we were there, we rolled out a system that would ingest all the receipts from every store in America and eventually other countries as well. Put them in a central database. And then you could offer feeds to other users. For instance, like we had some integration with, what was the name of it? Walmart's DVD service, Vudu, I think it's called. Is that what it was called? Yeah. So a cool interaction there is you could do something like say, hey, whenever anyone buys a DVD, they automatically get a copy of the digital version of this video. So if we know their customer ID number, we can just unlock the video at the time of purchase. And it's just kind of all automatic.
Behavior I have personally witnessed. In the service.
Yeah. It is funny. I do laugh to my wife when we walk into Sam's and they'll say, you know, have you heard about our cash back program? And I lean over and I'm like, yeah,
I wrote the code.
Well, I didn't write it, but yeah, I wrote a lot of integration for that. So at the time when we were building that system, this is a good study for people and I believe how to write systems well. The first thing we did is we sat down it was a week. On location with a big whiteboard and sat down and said, let's write down everything that's in this entire system, everything that we need to talk to, where the data needs to be stored. And we did that. And then we started writing down, the scale numbers, right? I believe the initial ingestion was something like 1,000 transactions a second at peak, you know, Black Friday or whatever.
Sure.
And so then you start drawing lines between your services and say, okay, this service is going to only forward on half of the results from the previous service. Okay. So you put half there, you know, now we're at 500 or whatever. And then you start doing delivery guarantees at different points too. So some things like getting data into the database needs to be at least once. I don't care if it's more. If we try to insert this 100 times in the database, that's fine because we can detect that it's there and not duplicate it. But we want to make sure it's at least there once. Other things like sending a text to a person that an order is fulfilled or something like that, you want at most once because, right, you know, if something fails, you don't want to spam their phone with 100 notifications. And if they don't get a notification, you know what? That we have other ways, yes, of notifying.
Better to deprive them of the opportunity to receive that value than annoy them.
Exactly. And we did something that a coworker of mine at the time, Tim Ewald, said. He's like, then you just start, take that diagram and just start cutting lines in between the modules and say, okay, what happens if this goes down, if this goes down? And what we realized when we were done is that this is really just a system of processors connected by queues. And at the time, about the only game in town for a queue processing system was Storm, Apache Storm, which is now Apache Storm. At the time, it was a Clojure product that was wrapped in Java APIs for Java people.
That didn't quite right. I didn't know that was the genesis of Storm.
Yeah. So Storm was written in the Clojure community, and then they layered enough Java on top of it that, and no one understood the Clojure part. That, so pretty now soon, Storm.
Okay.
Yeah, Storm 2 now is, or whatever the current incarnation is called, is pure Java.
We apologize for any inconvenience, but
right. Go on. Yeah, exactly. Several years after that, a friend of mine in the Clojure community created what's called Onyx. Michael Drogalis, I think is his name. And he's gotten some funding and stuff and kind of written a more Clojure purist view of stream processing. And I just bumped my mic.
Drogalis, never heard of him.
Okay.
Yeah, he's a recent guest on Streaming Audio.
Okay. And a co-worker. Okay, excellent. So, yeah, exactly. So, so I was, he and I, corresponded a fair amount back when that was in the infancy, and, it's gone on to be a successful project, and we probably would have used it had it existed at the time, but this system predated Onyx by, 3-4 years. So in the end, we decided to just roll our own, and we took a very solid, and simplistic view of this. And that, the story I like to tell people is we said, you know, what does Erlang do? Erlang is has a great architecture for dealing with failures. And that is when you encounter an error, you crash the process.
Yeah. You die.
And they have
somebody recreates you.
Yeah, exactly. So that was our starting point. When we have an error, we crash the JVM. And obviously that's a horrible solution, because, you know, you got restart times and stuff, but it gives you that base level of like, now, you know, all your state is wiped out when there's an error, you know, things automatically retry, and that sort of nature. So we kind of started there and then started classifying errors and saying, okay, errors of this type, a parse error of the like, we don't need to crash the JVM over a simple parse error. We can just fail that message. And we kind of built up from there. But in between those different processes, we had to have a queue. We considered Kafka at the time. I think Kafka was 0.8 back then. And so it was a question of, do we trust this technology enough at that point? We kind of did. The ops team at Walmart was like, well, you know, we have queue systems. If you wouldn't mind using one of those, it'll be less overhead for us. So we ended up going with a commercial product that they had that was, from what I understand, insanely expensive, but at least the ops department knew it and it worked well. Having a team completely dedicated to maintaining your messaging queue is a very valuable service.
Yes.
Looking back on it now, and if Kafka was where it is now, we certainly would have used that. In fact, it would have changed how we did some things. So the first part of that whole system was what we called the fat queue. It's just this fire hose of information, and our main concern there is just get it into solid and into durable storage as fast as possible. And so all that would do is just intake from that queue as fast as we could and insert it into Cassandra. And based on that, we now have a key value store where we can just forward on IDs and say, hey, if you need the data, it's in Cassandra at this place. But it's interesting to see how that, mutable queue plus Cassandra doesn't look a whole lot different from what Kafka would have looked like. You know, we can, we can go look up information if we need it. It's maybe durable.
Some differences in Tombstone performance here and there, but that's for the ops guys.
And the data was accumulate only. We never deleted it, so it really was. You know,
that was not a problem.
Yeah. So that system actually ended up working fairly well. I wasn't in the war room the first day we hit Black Friday, but the other employees at Walmart were, to quote them, they got all their Red Bull set up and everything ready to go. And because it's 24 hours of just madness in the ops department on Black Friday, and they all got in front of their displays and then just sat there and drank soda for 12, 15 hours and nothing happened, which was perfect.
What year would this have been?
Oh, wow. That would have been
14 or 15, maybe.
Yeah. If you want to read more about this too, or there's a good talk by Anthony Marcar. I believe it's called, let's see here.
I ask because I was deeply involved in the Cassandra community at the time and remember stories of a completely uneventful, boring Black Friday, at least with respect to a certain product team.
Yes.
That was a Cassandra-based application. They're like, you know, it was all hands on deck and a bunch of consultants there, and they're not even able to finish their Red Bulls, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but in 2014, I just looked it up. There's a great talk by Anthony Marcar called Closure at Scale that came out in April 22nd of 2015, and that's on YouTube if anyone wants to look that up. And he goes over this architecture in a little more detail and just kind of the lessons we learned working on that project. The big takeaway from that is when you build a system that's processors connected by queues, you can take the processors up and down. The queues will continue to accumulate data as long as you don't have strict delivery guarantees, which we did not at the time. The net effect of that whole thing was by the time Anthony had moved on from Walmart, he said they went about 2 years without a downtime. Wow. The system was up. We took servers down, we upgraded software, but it was all, you know, hidden behind queues. So users never noticed.
And so that basic meta architecture proved to be a robust template.
Exactly. Yeah, extremely. And I think it was scaled up to, I think we had 100 servers processing the information at one point.
There were definitely people using Kafka for things like that in 2014, 2015, but one can be forgiven back in those days.
We wanted to, and it was really, you could just see it. The look in the ops guys, they're like, it's alpha.
Literally going to hunt you down. If you,
it's not that bad. I know. They're like, we know it's not that bad. We don't want to learn another piece of tech.
Again, Cassandra was like going 2.0 then.
Right.
And yeah, so that all makes sense. And again, like you said, had it to do over again, that would have been clear cut in the contemporary environment.
Yeah, definitely.
This, I were working towards the subject of our discussion. How does this get you to your interest in and involvement with MicroCanron? And in fact, tell us what MicroCanron is.
Right. So MicroCanron is a paper that was introduced in a paper that was released in 2013. It's called MicroCanron, a minimal functional core for relational programming. And it's a subset of something called MiniCanron. The concept we want to really talk about first and establish a definition for is that concept of relational programming. In fact, Canron is apparently a form or of a Japanese word meaning relation, and that's how that comes across. But it's the idea of programming through relations between data as opposed to inputs and outputs. So in normal imperative programming, you will say X plus Y equals Z. And so if X and Y have to have a value for that to work, right? X would be 1, Y would be 2, so therefore Z is 3. But as we all know from algebra, you can swap those around and you could say, you know, X plus Y equals Z. And what if Y is the one that doesn't have the value? And so relational programming is about defining relations between variables. So whatever Z is, it is X and Y added together. And you could define enough of these relations or rules that you can then ask the program, the interpreter, to solve the program for you. And it will give you an answer or no answer or many answers. So in the case of, you know, the term we give these variables is bound. So if a variable is bound, that means we know what it is at that point in execution in the program. So as an example, I could say X and Y are unbound, but X plus Y equals Z, and Z is bound to 3. So now there's an unlimited number of answers to that program, right? You could have 1 plus 2 equals 3. You could have, 3 minus 1. 3 plus negative 1 is, I guess it'd be 4 plus negative 1 is 3. Don't do math in your head on a podcast. Yeah, exactly.
We will check the math afterward, but
right, exactly.
You bind one and the program has enough relationships defined where it's able to reason in a strict way about.
Right. And astute listeners will probably recognize some of this as logic programming or Prolog. If you've ever, a lot of people in college have encountered Prolog, and there's any number, there's as many jokes about Prolog as there are about Lisp. It's a strange programming language.
Yep.
But you can start to.
There are many fewer Prolog programmers these days than Lisp programmers. Kind of around, the early 90s when my career was beginning, that was a thing that you'd see magazine articles about at least. Yeah. And maybe there was that one weird guy who did it some, but it was never current. But, Lisp, there's Lisp all around us.
Right. Yeah. There is now. Well, it's Lisp is what the universe is made out of. So it's everywhere. But, So this idea of mini Cameron was there's a paper, and even a man by the name of William Byrd did his doctoral thesis on it. Is this idea of embedding a relational interpreter in a programming language, and most commonly that is a Lisp of some sort. Lisps, you're writing in data. And when you write the language, and so it's fairly easy to make compilers and transpilers and interpreters in Lisp. So it's kind of a nice fit. The paper uses Scheme and shows how you can embed one of these relational interpreters in another language. So you don't have to write in Prolog. You can write in whatever language you want. And there's translations into Python, Java, C#, JavaScript, you name it. And the idea would be, you can kind of do all your work out, all your normal work outside of this relational system. And then when you need to solve a problem that requires it, you can kind of load up this library and feed in some values and get answers out. Mini-Cameron is very large, and there's a lot of features to it and a lot of things to consider. But then Micro-Cameron is a subset of that. So William Byrd and I believe it was a student that he worked with, sat down and said, how can we just start pulling things out of this until we boil it down to the essence of what it is that we've invented in essence here? And that is Micro-Cameron. So the implementation of Micro-Cameron is 50 lines of Scheme code. It's very small. And that's enough to get basic relations going. And these relations not only just apply to numbers, but they apply to data structures. So you could say, X is a list of 1, 2, and 3, those numbers in a list. And then Y is the first of that list, or Y is one of the items in that list. So if you have a list of 1, 2, and 3, and you say Y is one of the values in that list, you now have 3 answers to that program, which is 1, 2, and 3. And so you can start to build up more complex rules off this system. So it was several years ago, many years ago, I guess, back in 2013, when I was talking to William Byrd, and I admitted that I knew how to use CoreLogic, which was a closure take on Mini-Cameron, but I never actually understood how the basics of it work. And he's like, well, hey, read this paper that we're coming out with, because it's not that hard. And so I sat down and started reading. And sure enough, and the thing that struck me at the time reading this paper was the entire core of Micro-Cameron works off this idea of, we have an environment that says what we know about the program. X is 1 and Y is equal to X. That's what we currently know. So what we then have, what this interpreter runs off of, is a stream of these environments. If you say this is true and this other thing is true, that and may remove elements from that stream because they don't apply. You said X is 1, and now you say Y is equal to X, and Y is also equal to 2. Well, that doesn't work because we already said Y is equal to X and X is equal to 1. So that environment would get cut out. That's called a conjunction, adding rules together. Disjunction is like an or. So that kind of adds items to the stream. You can say X is equal to 1 or X is equal to 2. And now you have two environments, one in which X is 1 and one in which X is 2. And that really, it was one of those moments when I was just reading this, trying to distill it even more into my mind, because the one thing I will say about these papers is that they work off of monads and are very...
We
don't all have to groan, but yeah,
That was a little, bit of a slightly groany.
But that was my reaction as well, was really? But when I read that part of the paper that says these are streams of environments, the closure mind in me said, well, I have like three or four ways of dealing with streams of data in closure. I have lazy sequences or like iterators in Java. I have transducers, which are kind of a reactive extensions push-based model. And then I have core async, which is like Go's channels. I mean, an asynchronous, could I build a parallel, you know, processing thing like Mini Canron, but everything is shifting values around through asynchronous pipelines. You know, hey, could you build this with Kafka queues in between the clauses? The answer to all of that is yes. And also it's a terrible idea and it's really slow for the like ideas of separating clauses in your program with Kafka queues.
That would be bad. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I've built stuff like that and it's fun. It's funny to see it work, but it's horribly inefficient, but there's a middle ground there. And so I sat down and started writing a series of like tutorials, which are probably somewhere online. It's been years now, but also just working through this on my own. How can we improve on this design or make it simpler to understand? And through several jobs at that time, I found places to apply this. So what I started realizing was that the other problem with this monadic structure is monads are basically function compositions. So you take functions and you kind of glob them together and compose them. But what you get out is a, go ahead.
I was going to say, would you, before you go on, maybe take another swing at that for listeners who are not deep in abstract algebra or, you know, functional programming language of your choice,
right?
What's a monad?
Yeah. So, The number one rule of monads is that no one understands them. And when you do, you are incapable of telling other people how they work.
Also my experience.
Yes. And so I don't know that I can try to do it all that well, but it's basically a way of composing functions so that you could build something like iterators in Java in a way that does not mutate data. It doesn't change data. Your different steps. If you were to say, here's a list of numbers, and you filter, and then you add one to each number. Each one of those steps could be a set of functions that compose together. And so you put a value in the top, and it comes out the bottom, and nothing is ever mutated in between. People who know how the list monad works know I just described that horribly, but that's the basic idea: is that you're kind of you're composing these functions together in a way that does not require mutation.
Got it. So you have immutable data, and that'll sound familiar to Kafka people, you know, because events are like that. Events are like that anyway. And compose functions, meaning you have little bundles of functions that call each other.
Right. And a lot of it too is about like, you know, you have a step function that takes as an argument kind of the next step to execute. And so you can kind of chain them by injecting in form of like dependency injection, I guess the next step.
Got it.
What this ends up being though is in the object oriented world, people kind of complain about what's known as the God object, one object that does everything. And in my opinion, that's one of the downfalls of this monadic style of programming is that everything is a function. Most of the functions aren't even named. And so everything's the same. They're all functions that take one or two arguments and it's just a blob. And so it's often nice to be able to introspect that, to look at it, but you can't really do that with functions. You can't take them apart. You can look at it at the code level, but once you create one of these interpreters, you know, Minicanter interpreters and Mucanter interpreters, and you look at it, it's just a function that you call with something. And what does this do? How do I know what it's doing? So another secret in software engineering, that is when any problem software engineering can be solved with another layer of abstraction. So that's pretty much what I ended up doing, is saying, okay, let's not have this built-in in language, this DSL. Let's not have that DSL emit monads that compose, or functions that even compose, but let's have it emit an abstract abstract syntax tree. Basically, let's have it emit data.
Yeah.
And so now we can print that data. We can look at it. We can rearrange the data. And if anyone's actually interested in seeing this in practice, there is a YouTube video from the Den of Clojure. It's a Clojure meetup group in Denver, which is the area where I'm from. Just look at my name, Tim Baldridge, Den of Clojure on YouTube, and it'll pop up. But I go through step by step for this. Yeah, that'll work. But the idea being then, okay, so if we emit this tree of data structures, and ands are one type of node in that tree, and ors are another type of tree, a node, we can start to analyze this. So one of the problems with this relational programming is you have certain rules you have to keep in mind when you write a language, write a program in this language. And anyone, even in Prolog, will probably have encountered this, that let's do an example here. In the talk I gave, there's a I take a data set. I used to play fairly heavily the game EVE Online, which is a massively multiplayer game that has a lot of star systems you travel through and trade and that sort of stuff, or fight. But there's a certain value to finding systems that border high security space where the police are in charge and low security space where the police are less in charge. And so the problem I proposed in this talk was, let's write a logic program that says, find me star systems that border both low and high security space. And so the two ways you could write that would say, find all the high security systems, now find all the low security systems, now find the ones that are linked together by a Stargate. And the problem with that result, that writing a program that way, is there may be 1,000 star high security star systems, 1,000 low, and now you're doing a match between those that's O times N.
That's a N squared graph.
N squared. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And suddenly, you know, you said connected by a Stargate. I'm like, oh wait, there's a graph problem here now. You didn't, it was my understanding there would be math, just not that kind of math.
Right. Yeah. It's a graph problem, right?
Yeah.
So the correct way to write that program is to say, you know, find me all the high security systems, and now find me all the ones that have a Stargate, and find all the Stargates in those systems. Now find all the ones that link to a low security system, because there's only 4 Stargates in each system. And that's a drastically smaller search space. But if you look at the data, you realize something. And index the data and put a histogram on it or something, what you realize is, oh, there are drastically fewer, low security systems than there are high security systems. So we really should start there. Find all the low ones that are linked to the high. So there's this ordering problem where, depending on how you order the clauses, it may take, 10 milliseconds, it may take 10 seconds, or in the worst case, it could take, you know, years to find the answer to this problem. And so that's a lot of what I started to apply in my job for these systems, is that users will want to often come up to a system and write a query. Cisco is now the second place where I've written a user-facing system that has a query language that we present to them. It could be in a GUI format, which is what we're working on at Cisco, or in at a bank that I mentioned earlier. It was more of a financial people. They kind of understood a little more about it, but they had a language. They would write out a query, and we want to give them the power of a programming language, of a query language, like something like SQL, but they really don't understand the data. A lot of times I don't understand the data. Sometimes I will run a histogram system, analysis of this data set, and it comes back with something I never expected. I see some relation in the data that I never knew it was there, but a program can see that. So the idea would be allow users to write the program in whatever format they want, the query. And then we can optimize that by taking what we know about the data to reorder clauses and, you know, execute part of the query ahead of time.
As you were saying earlier, having some domain knowledge, exactly. That optimization is easier.
Yeah, exactly. Domain knowledge. And sometimes you may just know that this entity is only ever has one relationship in the database. There may be a 10 million of both of them, but it's a one-to-one relationship between both. So there's a lot of that sort of stuff you can feed in. And once you're done, you can either execute that AST or compile it to Clojure code. I mean, it's all data, right? So you could just compile it to Clojure code and eval it. And now you have a JIT interpreted, just-in-time compiled query engine. And surprisingly, this stuff works. So
yes, you do. All right. No, that comes together.
Yeah. Now I should mention one of the things in this mini Canron world that a phrase you'll hear a lot is running stuff backwards. And I know it's kind of a pet peeve of, cause I've heard him mention it before of William Byrd that a lot of people take this technology and use it to write query engines because we're kind of taking the cool parts and leaving some other stuff on the floor. And that is if you really have a relation, like we were talking about earlier, X plus Y equals Z, a lot of what I've been doing in the past few years is just making one of those. You can either have X be an unknown or Z, but not X and Y, right? You can't have this open-ended, find me all the possible answers to this problem. That's where stuff gets really interesting. And if you want to, and so the idea of running something backwards is I want to write a program. Think of an interpreter. An interpreter takes some state and an input program and produces more state. And so a lot of the research William Byrd has been doing has been like, let's invert that. We can write a relational interpreter that says, here's a program. Here's the output of that program. What was the initial state before we ran that? Because it runs the program backwards. But you can do other weird stuff. Here's the output state and here's the input state. Now show me the code, all the possible code that could have produced this output. And if you really want to get crazy, it's just like, here's just the output of the program. Show me variants of the input state and the input program that could have produced this. And that gets really fun. Limited in use perhaps, but yeah, because you could do function search, right? You're programming your favorite, you're in your favorite IDE and you say, okay, I have an input long or a float variable and I have a string. What functions in my system would produce this output given this input? Right. And you could do a search and find them.
Now, apply this. We started talking about the work that you did at Walmart, which was kind of a pre-mainstream Kafka thing that would have been a Kafka thing if it were now.
Right.
Given your experience with that kind of architecture, which was you called them queues and then you had a separate persistent store, but if you had a distributed durable log, that would be like beautiful for that kind of thing. So imagine that sort of problem. Where does a thing, imagine the system where you get to marry these two. Just talk about that.
Yeah. So what I've described so far is primarily what's known as like first order logic. Prolog fits into this as well, that you primarily have a set amount of data. Databases work this way. Yeah. In general, your data set is unchanging. And you're writing arbitrary queries against that data. Now, I know your data changes all the time, but the model is mostly that you have these highly optimized indices on the data, and the indices don't change, the structure of that data doesn't change, but you write ad hoc queries. The other type of system that it kind of switches those variables around are what are known as production rule systems, or ReDy networks, which is the idea that your queries aren't going to change, but the data that flows through them is going to be the constantly changing thing. So a lot of banks, like airlines and companies like that will use this sort of system. It's kind of a trigger system. So if you can imagine a problem that you might experience in an airline is whenever a user hits 10,000 miles traveled, they get some reward, right? And maybe they get bonus miles if they travel during the daytime. Now, what you could do is every day have a batch job that says, go out to my database and find all the users that have meet these requirements. But that could be a lot of data and a lot of churning to do. And that's more the offline approach. And years ago, there used to be a kind of a fad of map reduce architectures that follow this approach of just, we have a ton of data. We're just going to throw a lot of processing power at it and just run a batch job once a day that pulls this information out. But there's a more efficient way to do this. And that is to write those queries ahead of time and more or less set them in stone. And then to have the data that comes in, view it as a stream of data. So a transaction comes through that says, this user traveled from point A to point B. And there may be a node. It pictured as like an execution node, a graph of these nodes connected. And then the data comes in, first of all. And one node says, you know what? I'm interested in anyone who traveled by aircraft. Okay, well, this event is someone traveled by aircraft. Great. So they get their copy of the data, mutable copy of the data. Somebody else says, you know, I'm interested in anyone who travels during a certain time of day. Another person, I'm processed, right? It says, anyone that travels during a certain time of day, I'm interested in that. And so the environments in this case, it's like we were talking about before with Minicanron. In Minicanron, you had a stream of environments. In this case, you have a stream of data, and the environment is more or less static in memory. It's building up secondary indices, and you're flowing the data through the system that mutates the what we know about these different people. We know that Bill has traveled 40 miles so far. Now he's traveled 50 as these events come in. And so these systems are called production rule systems, and it's really hard to describe without whiteboards and all that. But the idea is that a lot of these concepts I've been working on with Minicanron and specifically building up this AST, building a production rule system off of that is just a different interpretation of the same logic. In both of those, you could say Z equals X plus Y. It doesn't matter if X changes over time or Y changes over time. I just want Z to always be X plus Y. If we get another variant of Y, then we get another output of the system. And so that's the thing that I haven't built that I really want to, is a lot of these systems I've built with a little tweaking and someone who wants to pay me to do it. Yeah, I could flip the execution around. I've built, you know, proof of concepts of this before. And it's one of those things whenever I mention to my boss, he's like, yeah, this could actually work, you know? And we just never, the problem is that often it's just faster and cheaper to run a batch job. You have to have really weird constraints to be able to say, no, we don't want to wait for that batch job to run. Airlines are a good example of that because they have so many people that fly them so often that often, you know, just running this batch job every night, or maybe they don't even want to wait. You know, something like a bank may not want to wait until a day has passed to run these offline queries. In those cases, these rule systems provide faster feedback at a cost. The cost is your indices now aren't offline; they're in memory. Basically, you're building as the data comes in. You're building the indices in memory, and the queries have to be static. There are some very expensive production rule systems that allow you to change the queries on the fly. But in general, whenever you want to change the queries of these systems, you have to dump all your data and re-ingest it. And that obviously takes time.
Certainly. But I think the number of, we'll say, people who are wanting to do this kind of thing on a real-time basis, that's a growing population, right? It used to be, well, I mean, banks and airlines and governments are kind of the traditional large scale things, I guess traditionally other transportation businesses, you know, where they were using computers in the 60s because it actually made sense for them to make the crazy kinds of investments that it took to use computers back then. And they're always the first ones to kind of chip away at use cases like this. And so the examples that come to mind are banks and airlines who might possibly need it. But it's not as weird as it used to be to want to do sophisticated kinds of things on event data. So
Absolutely. And one of the problems you run into, so I've worked on systems that have naive at most. Okay. Everyone takes the naive approach first. We have systems at Cisco, data feeds, right? Here's a data feed. And the first thing you do to solve a thing like this is you have a global data feed. It's every event of a certain type, and maybe you can pass in one parameter. And all that really does is here's your stream, event stream, and we're going to apply a function, a filter function, yes or no. But what that doesn't allow you to do is to take into account changes over time. So at one place at the bank, we hit this problem where people may be interested in certain transactions in certain portfolios, but portfolios had a hierarchical structure where one portfolio may be inside another portfolio, and that structure could change over time. And so it wasn't just as simple as saying, you know what, we want to accept transactions from portfolio 5 and 6. It was, oh, 5 and 6 didn't change. Those portfolios didn't, but they were included in another portfolio. So now you need to add these or not add these to the stream. And so that's a whole nother problem when you deal with multiple sources of information, multiple types of events that all interact. And that gets complex. The other thing is just processing time. So one place I worked at, we had this naive solution where it was just a filter function, but it got to the point where if you have 200 customers and they all have a custom filter, then you may be doing a lot of logic. You may be duplicating a lot of execution. What's the word phrase? You're duplicating work, right?
Yeah, work.
Wasting time calculating the same thing twice. And these Reedy networks. Reedy is an implementation of this. Reedy networks are, and so I use that term sometimes. But those systems also work by you could give it a whole set of queries. So here's 100 queries I want to track against this incoming data stream. And there's a way of reducing the amount of calculations that have to be performed. So parts of those queries that reference the same data can be deduped and reduce, and therefore you can reduce calculation time. So yeah, that's the problem with this approach, is that the naive solutions work well enough until they don't. And right. So it's often a thing of, do we just add more machines or do we spend time to do it right, you know? So,
and that's one of these days. And one of these days, that is exactly why I wanted to talk to you about this, because to your knowledge, and you would know, nobody is doing this with Kafka, but it sounds like a thing that maybe ought to happen. Maybe somebody's doing it, and maybe this is our way of finding out. So,
absolutely. And I think there's a lot of room in this day and age for it, with stuff with like Lambda architectures and a lot of this other stuff to, take a more distributed approach to this too. Onyx did this, kind of, we're going to split your program up into individual functions. And then even if they're in memory queues, we're going to express this as queues between functions. And so I've wanted to go down that approach as well and just say, you know, if you look at a Reedy network, go read Wikipedia article on that to get a good overview of how it works. But you're talking about hundreds of nodes connected by event streams. What if each one of those could be on a different machine? You could scale that really well.
Yeah. So if this is a thing that you're interested in, and I speak to you in the listening audience, reach out in community Slack. I think this is these seem like ideas that need to come together. This needs to be a thing that somebody needs to do in the context of event streaming. And if it's happening, we'd love to know about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other, I mean, there's, so in Clojure, there's Clara. And I also have, which is a production rule system. It's a wrapper around a Java system, I think. But there's also, I have to give a shout out, ThreatGrid, the group at Cisco I work at, also has a variant of this called Naga, which is a Clojure library for doing production rules. But a lot of these systems kind of, you write in one language for your production rules and you query in another. And so one of these days when I get more time, I'd love to sit down and work on a library that allows you to do both. That kind of, you know, you can write the query once and it's really just a variant of relation programming, just taking different parts of the program and saying, this was bound, or, you know, we knew what this was. We don't know what this is. This is a stream. This is an actual database. Now let's swap that around. You know, it's just replacing the parts of these relational programs with a slightly different logic.
That's definitely a project I encourage you to undertake. My guest today has been Tim Baldrige. Tim, thanks for being a part of Streaming Audio.
Thank you. It's been wonderful.
And there you have it. I hope this podcast was helpful to you. If you want to discuss it or ask a question, you can always reach out to me at TL Berglund on Twitter. That's at TLBERGLUND. Or you can leave a comment on a YouTube video or reach out in community Slack. There's a Slack sign-up link in the show notes if you want to register there. And while you're at it, please subscribe to our YouTube channel and to this podcast wherever fine podcasts are sold. And if you subscribe through iTunes, be sure to leave us a review there. That helps other people discover the podcast, which we think is a good thing. So, thanks for your support, and we'll see you next time.